Good afternoon and welcome everyone. I'm Jenny Hayward-Jones. I'm the Melanesia Program Director at the Lowy Institute. It's my great pleasure today to welcome for the first time to the Lowy Institute in Sydney, although not the first time at a Lowy Institute event, the New Zealand Minister of Foreign Affairs, the Honourable Murray McCulley. Minister, I'd like to thank you for being here today, and I think it's important that you are giving this speech here a week in advance of Prime Minister Turnbull delivering the 2016 Lowy Lecture on Australian Foreign Policy next week. The annual Lowy Institute poll features a thermometer which we use to measure Australians' feelings towards other countries. On every occasion that we've included New Zealand in the list of countries we mention in the feeling question, it tops the thermometer, last year at a very warm 83 degrees. Although New Zealand's consistent warm rating on our thermometer is predictable from our point of view, we hadn't realised how valuable an indicator it was of New Zealand's diplomatic successes in Australia until 2013, when we didn't include New Zealand in the list, and the New Zealand High Commissioner was on the phone the next day to make representations about why we had deleted New Zealand. So we know we like New Zealand, but that doesn't necessarily translate to a sophisticated public understanding of New Zealand foreign policy, and I'm sure you'll be able to help us improve that understanding today. The Minister is a frequent visitor to Australia and notably a frequent visitor to our neighbours in the South Pacific, where he has cultivated close relationships with counterpart governments. In fact, the last time I saw him was in Port Moresby, where we both spoke at an ANZ conference on electricity last year. And now I'd like to extend personal thanks to the Minister for taking an active interest in the work of the Institute and in my program, the Melanesia Program in particular. My first couple of years here coincided with Mr. McCulley's first few years as the New Zealand Foreign Minister from 2008. While I was focused on trying to influence Australian foreign policy in the Pacific, I received more feedback and interest in my research from Mr. McCulley than I did from our own Foreign Minister at the time, so I'd really like to thank you for that. Mr. McCulley also supported us hosting our second major Pacific Islands and the World Conference in Auckland in 2011, where he delivered his second address to the Lowy Institute, and he delivered the first in Brisbane at our first Pacific Islands and the World Conference 2 years before that. So we have a long history, the Minister and I. It is therefore a great honour for me to be introducing one of the earliest supporters of the Melanesia Program. Of course, New Zealand's foreign policy interests are not limited to the Pacific Islands region, and the Minister will be talking about a broader range of subjects today. New Zealand is 1 year into its 2 year term on the United Nations Security Council, where it is pressing action on the Middle East peace process. And as is the case for Australia, New Zealand's economic prospects are increasingly tied to partners in the Asia Pacific region, most prominently with China, but also with the countries of ASEAN. The Honourable Murray McCulley has been the Minister of Foreign Affairs since 2008. He is the Member of Parliament for East Coast Bays in the New Zealand Parliament and also holds the portfolio of Associate Minister for Sport and Recreation. Please join me in welcoming the Honourable Murray McCulley.
Thank you, Ginny, and good afternoon. I'm still on New Zealand time, but good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, distinguished guests. Thank you very much for the opportunity to address you today, and can I acknowledge the New Zealand High Commissioner to Australia, Chris Seed, who's come over from Canberra for this occasion, and any other members of the diplomatic community who are here. Today I want to give you an overview of New Zealand's international priorities for 2016, provide an update on our work in the United Nations Security Council, and talk about our role in the Pacific. But first of all, the reason I'm here in Australia. Tomorrow I will be in Canberra for the 6 monthly consultations with Julie Bishop. Given our shared values and interests, as much that we as foreign ministers have to discuss, the agenda is extensive and includes international developments in the Middle East, East Asia, our immediate neighbourhood and the Southwest Pacific. Depth and breadth of our meeting reflects the fact that New Zealand has no more important partner than Australia. Australia is New Zealand's largest economic partner, so I don't need to make the case to New Zealand audiences for why Australia matters. I suspect the significance of the New Zealand market is not fully recognised here in Australia. That reflects the reality that we are only your fifth largest export destination, yet it should be appreciated that we are especially important to some big sectors of your economy. 17,000 Australian businesses export to New Zealand every year. That compares to 8,000 exporting to the United States and 5,000 exporting to China, your single largest export market. What that tells you is that New Zealand is especially important to your small and medium-sized enterprises across all states and all sectors. Tourism is booming in Australia, just as it is in New Zealand. But do you know where most of your visitors are coming from? New Zealand is your largest source of inbound visitors, with over 1.2 million New Zealanders visiting every year. Your businesses and shareholders have roughly 100 billion Australian invested in New Zealand. New Zealand has about 55 billion Australian invested over here. This is a product of the single economic market that both governments on both sides of the Tasman have worked to progress over three decades now. There are around 55,000 New Zealanders, there are around 550,000 New Zealanders living in Australia. We can argue over who owns Crowded House, Russell Crowe and Quade Cooper, but we think of the CEOs of three of your four banks as being New Zealanders. It's not only the New Zealanders at the big end of town who are making a difference. Most New Zealanders here are pulling their weight. For instance, they earn more than the average Australian and therefore pay more tax. It may surprise you to know that more people are currently moving to New Zealand from Australia than going the other way. The movement of people reflects the free flow of goods, services and capital and is good for both countries. We are both Asia-Pacific nations with regionally focused outlooks and for good reason. Some of our major exports, such as dairy, wine and meat, are in high demand in Asian economies. To put it plainly, we sell the products that the emerging middle classes of Asia want. By 2020, the number of middle-class consumers in Asia is expected to triple to 1.75 billion people. This reflects a massive opportunity for both for New Zealand exporters and also for our tourism operators. But our focus on the Asia-Pacific goes beyond trade and extends to political and security considerations. Instability in the region now affects New Zealand's interests more directly than ever before. The regional organisations designed to build political security and economic cooperation, such as APEC and the East Asia Summit, are vital for New Zealand. These organisations build the region's collective sense of well-being, trust and resolve to address challenges to regional stability and prosperity. Heightened tensions in the South China Sea highlight the intersection between economic and security interests in the region. A particular cause of increased strain has been reclamation and construction activity and deployment of military assets in disputed areas. We regard all of these activities as unhelpful, regardless of the party responsible. We were pleased to hear President Xi Jinping's commitment last year that China would not militarise new features. We would like to see all claimants move further to demilitarise disputed areas. While New Zealand does not take a position on the various territorial disputes, we do have a stake in how these disputes are managed. It directly affects our interests. As a country with one of the largest EEZs in the world, the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea is particularly important to us. So are the international legal principles of freedom of navigation and overflight. They are vital for New Zealand's livelihood. We regret that some of those with interests in this process are not yet parties to the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea, and others have taken a narrow view of how the convention applies. We support the role arbitration can play in resolving complex disputes, and we support states' rights to access dispute settlement mechanisms. The Philippines has taken this route with its case before the arbitral tribunal, and a ruling is expected shortly. We expect all parties to respect the result of the tribunal's ruling. A great deal of focus has been placed on the role and aspirations of China as the major economic power in the region and emerging world power. In that respect, I'm both a realist and an optimist. A realist because the emergence of a huge economic power was always going to come with ambitions and aspirations to match, and some of these inevitably compete with established players and interests. Managing that process is the great challenge facing ASEAN regional diplomacy. But I remain an optimist because China has huge domestic challenges to meet. Sustained economic growth is critical to bringing about the internal transformation that is their key goal. And that sustained economic growth can only occur in an environment of peace and stability in this region. At the centre of the international rules-based system sits the United Nations Security Council, of which New Zealand's currently a non-permanent member, following in the footsteps of Australia's two-year term. There are some things that only the Council can do, like giving formal effect to the Iran nuclear deal. While much work remains to build the sustained trust between Iran and the international community over time, getting an agreement at all represents a huge achievement and reflects great credit on those most directly involved. But sadly, the divisions in the Council make this a rare achievement. The Council's not dealing with the most pressing global security issues of our time. Take the example of Syria, a slow-motion train wreck that has resulted in over a quarter of a million deaths, a huge humanitarian disaster, and a refugee crisis that has now engulfed Europe, not to mention the rise of ISIS and the widespread recruitment of foreign terrorist fighters. For 5 long years, the Security Council has been paralysed. Now, finally, we're seeing some positive movement. But the current truce is fragile. Some will no doubt point to the work the Council does in relation to Syria, Yemen and other trouble spots in asserting the case for humanitarian access. And whilst those efforts are valuable and constructive, they are not a substitute for the Council carrying out its responsibility to stop the conflict. Anything less represents failure. We want to see a Council that is able to put its political weight behind a permanent ceasefire in Syria. We also want to see the UN Security Council shoulder its responsibilities in the Middle East peace process. It has been 7 years since the Council even passed a resolution on this question. We keep being told that the time is not right and the parties are not ready. But while we wait, the situation on the ground gets worse, violence has escalated, and the viability of the two-state solution is disappearing as a consequence of Israeli settler activity. This question now looms as a serious challenge to the credibility of the Council. We recognise that as elected members, we all have to play our part. That is why last year, frustrated by the Council's lack of resolve, New Zealand circulated a draft resolution to try and find a pathway to bring the parties back to the negotiating table. Faced with the reality that a resolution would not succeed, we agreed to wait. Now the situation on the ground has deteriorated and the settlement activity has continued. As an elected member of the Council, we have a responsibility to make contributions. So we are again looking at a draft text for a resolution, and we are talking to parties more closely engaged in this issue to encourage them to act. For the Council to do nothing, while the scope for a two-state solution is completely undermined, would be a total abrogation of its responsibilities. We're also using our term to encourage a sharper focus on conflict prevention. There's something seriously wrong when we're spending $8 billion US a year on peacekeeping and a further $10.5 billion US providing humanitarian support for victims of conflict, but virtually nothing on the prevention of conflict. There's always, of course, the debate as to when the international community is justified in interfering in the affairs of sovereign nations. But it would be my observation that there is significant scope for the UN and the international community to engage earlier and more effectively to head off conflicts before they start. During our term on the Council, we're making contributions to improving the Council's day-to-day working methods and the use of the veto. The veto's impact today far exceeds what was envisaged in the UN Charter, to the huge detriment of the Council's effectiveness and credibility. New Zealand has long opposed the veto. We opposed it when the United Nations body was formed in the first place. We're working to support initiatives calling for restraint in the exercise of the veto and for more effort to be applied within the Council to avoid its use. That's why New Zealand is using its two-year term to demonstrate that we are more effective when we work as a Council of 15 rather than an elite group of 5. It is in all of our interests that we have a stronger and more relevant Council capable of fulfilling its intended purpose, and will continue to play our part in realising this goal. Finally, I want to refer to New Zealand's diplomatic and development work in the Pacific, where we greatly appreciate the excellent cooperation that exists with Australia. The large populations of Pacific peoples resident in New Zealand and extensive connections to the islands, we consider ourselves a Pacific nation. Added to that, the inhabitants of three separate territories in the Pacific, the Cook Islands, Niue and Tokelau, are passport-carrying New Zealand citizens. It's a no-brainer then that New Zealand has an extensive network of diplomatic missions across the region and that the majority of our development assistance is spent there, around 60%. I have consistently encouraged my ministry to aspire to be the world's centre of excellence in Pacific affairs. It's the greatest comparative advantage that New Zealand offers in the international space, our close relationship with the Pacific. We've recently sought to leverage our experience in the region by applying our skills in small island developing states outside the region, particularly in the Caribbean and the Indian Ocean. We used our presidency month last July in the Security Council to hold an event on the security challenges faced by small island developing states to give small island developing states, which constitute nearly a quarter of the UN membership, a chance to have their voices actually heard in the Council. New Zealand and Australia have a significant stake in the peace and security of the small island developing states in our region. By their very size, isolation and nature, our smaller neighbours often walk a thin line between success and failure. But in my view, there is no reason we can't increase this margin with targeted support that plays to the region's strengths. New Zealand and Australia work together in the Pacific to generate development outcomes, respond to crises, and seek solutions to the challenges we collectively face. Our overarching objective is to help build prosperity and stability in the Pacific. Many Pacific nations do not have the economic diversity to handle major shocks. Today, we're still counting the cost of the damage inflicted on Fiji by Cyclone Winston. Events such as cyclones can have disproportionate impacts on smaller states in the region. And you don't have to go too far back in time to see the impact of man-made shocks, such as the tensions in the Solomon Islands, Bougainville, or violence in Tonga. These security and development challenges can have regional consequences, the most obvious being that New Zealand and Australian troops, military assets, police, and funding get called upon to pick up the pieces. And more importantly, the aspirations and quality of life of Pacific peoples are seriously curtailed. This said, it is in my view too easy to get caught up in the narrative of long-term dependence and failure in relation to the Pacific. The region has some natural assets which are capable of making a much greater contribution to the sustainable economic development of the region, provided partners make targeted investments in areas that will maximise the income from these assets and reduce costs. For the small island states in this region, reliance on fossil fuels for electricity generation is economically and environmentally unsustainable, with diesel costs at around 10% of the region's GDP and up to 30% of the total import bill of some countries. For this reason, New Zealand's chosen to make major investments in renewable energy in the Pacific, and we are encouraging other major development partners, like the European Union and the World Bank, to get involved in the space. In March 2013, New Zealand and the EU hosted a Pacific Energy Summit to address these issues and match donors with the action plans developed by Pacific governments. The summit resulted in a funding envelope of 635 million New Zealand dollars and kick-started over 50 renewable energy projects across the region. For our part, New Zealand's Pacific energy portfolio is now in excess of 120 million in seven countries. In Tokelau, all three atolls previously dependent upon fossil fuel for electricity are now effectively 100% renewable through solar generation. In the Northern Cooks, we saw the Northern Cooks become effectively 100% renewable last year, as did all but one island in Tuvalu. We are supporting further progress in the larger islands of the Cooks, Tuvalu and Samoa, and we have renewable energy projects underway in Tonga, Kiribati, the Solomon Islands and Papua New Guinea. Another emerging focus for New Zealand's investments in the Pacific is information and communications technology. We're working with our Pacific Island partners to bring new submarine cable connectivity to the region. World-class internet is the key, not just a successful business environment for sectors like tourism, but also for improving health and education outcomes. In terms of economic viability, along with tourism, increasing revenue streams from fisheries is essential if we want to move the Pacific away from a reliance on development assistance. The Pacific's largest asset is the schools of tuna swimming in its oceans, which should be used to make their owners more economically sustainable than they are today. Currently, the Pacific owners of the tuna fisheries receive around 14% of their total market value. That's about, I think, 3.4 billion total last year in terms of value. And I've just seen a report this morning suggesting that it's about $600 million of fish taken out of the zone through illegal and unreported fishing. So that's a significant item. Many other players clip the ticket along the way through illegal and unregulated and unreported fishing, and it's a major drag on the potential of this resource. If we want the Pacific to be truly economically sustainable, we need the international community to cooperate to ensure that they receive a fair return from their fisheries. While there has been an increase in the amount of fish caught since 2012, the value of the key fisheries has fallen by over 20%. The current system doesn't reflect the true value of the resource, and this has led Pacific governments to look for new approaches to lift returns and safeguard fisheries for future generations. At last year's forum, Pacific leaders endorsed a move towards a catch-based management system for tuna by 2025. This is an area where New Zealand has extensive experience, and in addition to sharing our expertise, we've set aside $50 million to support the development of catch-based management systems in the Pacific over the next few years. If we can get this right and make it work, another block will be added to the foundation underpinning the Pacific's economic sustainability. I recognise that practical support to countries must be based on innovative thinking. In that respect, I want to underline that I've got a very high regard for research think tanks like the Lowy Institute and the role that you play in providing analysis and ideas. They say imitation is the sincerest form of flattery. This month, we'll be launching the New Zealand Institute for Pacific Research through a consortium led by Auckland University. Our aim is for the Institute to build a world-class research program focused specifically on Pacific issues. It will inform solutions for Pacific development, governance, security, and other public policy issues. This should give you an overview of New Zealand's international priorities for 2016. We are focused on the economic opportunities and security challenges in the Asia-Pacific region. We want to continue to push for meaningful action on the United Nations Security Council on a range of global issues and improve the way the Council works. And we want to continue working with our partners in the Pacific to make the region more resilient and sustainable. There are areas in which we work closely with Australia, and we look forward to our close cooperation continuing over the coming years. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Minister. The Minister has agreed to take questions today from the floor, but I'm going to kick off. Minister, you've paid a couple of visits to Fiji in the last couple of months. Like, as is the case with Australia, New Zealand-Fiji relations are expanding following the 2014 elections. How do you see your relations with Fiji evolving going forward, and particularly following the devastating cyclone?
Well, I think the relationship with Fiji in a formal sense normalised very quickly after the democratic elections were held there. We moved very quickly to put in place formal foreign policy talks and to put in place the steps required to increase development assistance. We'd wound it back to a fairly low level, and we quite quickly identified some ways in which we could increase development support and provide assistance in areas of capacity building. Areas like defence cooperation and so on. In fact, the Minister of Defence visited very soon after those elections as well. So I'd say that we've been building the relationship quite steadily, and you mentioned I've been to Fiji twice recently. The first was to start with formal talks for 2016, and about 10 days later I returned in the wake of the cyclone to make sure that we were on the job providing the humanitarian support and looking towards the recovery work that would need to be done. Look, it's impossible to completely clean the slate of some of the differences and challenges that might have existed during a difficult time in the relationship. Although I'm bound to say that in that respect, things were never quite as tough as in a diplomatic sense, as people would say. Yes, we had high commissioners expelled from Fiji and so on, but I was still a regular visitor to Fiji and used to have my counterpart come to New Zealand. We kept talks alive and I think made sure that we understood each other well so that when the time came we could resume a more normal, formal relationship. But the informal relationship, I think, was always in place. We are now, both Australia and New Zealand, very heavily engaged. We've got a significant part of our assets. I think we've got both the Wellington and the Canterbury there. We've had Hercules aircraft daily for a long period of time, 757 flights up there with stuff as well. And we're very focused on supporting Fiji in a what's going to be a $500 million recovery process. It's going to take some time. I think that if there's one thing that has come out of these tragic events, it is that it's been a reminder of the geography of the region. We are all involved in this region together. When one party needs help, we give it, and without qualification, and that's what we've tried to do and what Australia's tried to do when Fiji's are of need.
Good afternoon, I'm Venus Kalesi from the Australian Baha'i Community. I should start by thanking you for the way in which you have spoken out about the plight of the Baha'is in Iran and called for their rights to be fully realised. You've just had an official visit by Iran's Foreign Affairs Minister, who's now in Australia. And for the benefit of those who may not know, the government of Iran systematically persecutes the Baha'i community in that country as a matter of government policy. I understand that human rights was raised during his visit, and I'm interested to know how Dr. Zarif responded to discussions about human rights, particularly because there seems to be a rhetoric which denies such violations.
Yeah, we've just had Foreign Minister Zarif in New Zealand, and he knows very well that whenever we have a bilateral meeting that I'm going to raise human rights issues, and being a very clever diplomat, often tries to make sure he raises it before I do. So it's always going to be raised by one party or the other, and he, to give him credit, doesn't shy away from that discussion. I have to say, I also specifically raised the issue of the treatment of Baha'i people with Dr. Zarif, and we'll continue to do so while we see the sort of treatment that we have in, for sadly quite a long time. I think the diplomatic way for me to describe this is to say that there are a range of decision makers in the Iranian system. There are some who are looking to help build bridges more than others. With that in mind, we watched the recent elections, parliamentary elections and Assembly of Experts elections in Iran. And after an unpromising start where the moderate candidates seemed to do rather poorly at getting through the process, when it came to a vote, the outcome seems to have been one that should hopefully give President Rouhani and Foreign Minister Zarif more space to go about their work. I certainly hope that's the case. So I guess the disappointing thing is that having seen the Iran nuclear deal forged, there was an opportunity there to reset relationships across the region and see the same players who were named by Secretary General Ban Ki-moon in his address to the General Assembly last year, who were involved directly or through proxies in so many of the conflicts in the region. There was a chance to reset those relationships from Iran's point of view, and it hasn't been grasped yet. And if there's one thing I did do while he was in New Zealand, it was urge him to grasp that opportunity, because Iran needs it, the region needs it, and the whole world needs it to happen.
Gina.
Thank you so much, Your Excellency, Mr. McCauley, for your very insightful lecture. I'm Ji-Yong Song, Research Fellow and Director of Migration Policy here at Lowy Institute. But my question is not on migration, but on the role of New Zealand as a non-permanent member for the UN Security Council. I'm glad that you mentioned about the problems with the P5, not failing to tackle the pressing issues such as Syrian refugee crisis, Israel-Palestine and other issues you didn't mention, Kashmir, for example. But other problem is actually stemming from the P5 members themselves. I mean, we don't talk about China, South China Sea issues at the UN Security Council or the Chechnya caused by Russia. And another issue is that the modern warfare is not driven by state actors only, but non-state actors like Taliban or the decentralized terrorist groups. So as one of the non-permanent member of the UN Security Council, I'm just wondering whether New Zealand is willing to, would like to push for those issues for the UN Security Council. Thank you.
Well, you've given quite a long shopping list there, and perhaps I'll restrict myself to a fairly general comment. Firstly, it's always amazed me that permanent members that are so completely opposed to each other on some key issues can work in such a united fashion to try and preserve the prerogatives of permanent members of the council. In that respect, they've been very hard to separate. And we have done a few things informally to try and get the elected members to work more closely together as a group and to improve working methods more generally. Just some things you'd regard as common courtesies, like ensuring that countries that have their interests affected by a matter that's before the council get a chance to have their view heard, having council members listen to them. Those are courtesies, but they're important working methods areas that we've focused on. We talk a lot about what we think we can do to get matters of difficulty onto the council agenda. We look at how much capital we're using and whether we should be using that capital for some other purpose or saving it for another day. Now, difficult issues, but you do have to remind yourself that the Security Council term for an elected member is only 2 years and you don't want to die wondering. So we've worked pretty hard to be true to the countries that voted for us, and we'll continue to do that.
David Lees, Royal United Services Institute. I'd like to follow up Jenny Hayward-Jones's question and ask specifically the Melanesian Spearhead Group was set up when Fiji was excluded from the Pacific Islands Forum, and also Fiji managed to attract financial support from Russia and Indonesia and a few others to replace the money it wasn't getting from Australia and New Zealand. Are they some of the things you had in mind when you said you can't completely clear the slate, or are we making progress in those areas too in restoring the relationship?
Oh, look, I think we are resolving many of those historic issues. Another one is the creation of the PIDF, which when you boil it down was designed to provide a competitive vehicle for the Pacific Island Forum Secretariat and has been pretty successful at doing so, I might say, in places like New York. And I think one of the challenges that remains, well, there are two challenges that remain in terms of the Pacific Island Forum. One is to persuade Prime Minister Bainimarama to come to a leaders' meeting. They've agreed to participate in every other level. So that's a remaining challenge. And the other is to find a logical place in the architecture of the region for the PIDF. And I think there is one. And I think both of those two challenges might well be resolved at some stage together, hopefully. So we've made good progress so far, but there are some things that yet need to be addressed. I think Fiji has made a good deal of its look north strategy, and occasionally I'm at events where my counterpart, Rotu Inoki Kaburumbola, is ready to speak, and I say to him, are you going to make that look north speech again, Rotu Inoki? Because if you do, I'll have to make my speech telling people to look at a map. And that is the answer. You just need to look at a map, and we are interdependent in this region. We've seen a demonstration of that recently, Yes, there have been some difficult times, and there are some institutional aspects that still need to be addressed, but actually we're just getting on with it, and most of these things will get dealt with over time.
Jonathan Pryke, I'm a research fellow here in the Melanesia program at the Lowy Institute. Of the 165,000 odd Pacific Islanders living in Australia, about two-thirds of them identify as being Polynesian in nature, and that should raise some eyebrows for Australians, given that Melanesia is our backyard and we have most of our investments in aid and business relationships there. And it's driven largely by, I think, three key issues. Is that first is New Zealand's progressive migration policies towards Polynesian countries. The second is our open migration policy between Australia and New Zealand. And the third is a far less progressive policy between Australia and its Melanesian partners. I was hoping you could talk more about the development impact you think your progressive migration policies with Polynesia has, and what advice you'd give to the Australian government to try and improve our record on migration in the region.
Well, it's been my experience that foreign ministers that offer advice about domestic policy matters in another country generally tend not to be foreign ministers for very long, so I might decline that kind of invitation. What I would say is that from New Zealand's point of view, one of the mobility areas that we're most proud of is the RSE scheme, the Recognised Seasonal Employer Scheme, which brings people from right across the region, not just Polynesia, to New Zealand. 9,500 this year. The numbers have been growing every year to work in our horticultural and viticultural industries. So when people talk about the challenges of labour market mobility, there are significant challenges. This one is a demonstration of a win-win scenario. I can tell you, because I get lobbied by them, we would not get the investment of capital in the viticultural industry or the horticultural sector in New Zealand that we get unless we can demonstrate there'll be access for people to come in from around the region to harvest their product. So that's one area. I'm pleased to see Australia's got its own scheme up and running, and I think that's going to lead us towards much closer towards a positive outcome on the PACER Plus discussions, because the labour market mobility piece was always regarded as one of the really difficult discussions to be had at the end. So I think we've sort of got ahead of that that discussion now. We have three countries, three states, as I said in my formal remarks, that are part of New Zealand in terms of citizenship. And these people have significant rights, well, complete rights, to come and go from our country. And it's worth just reflecting on the numbers. From Tuvalu, there are about 1,500 people in Tuvalu, and probably 5,000 Tuvaluans, maybe 7,000 Tuvaluans in New Zealand. From Niue, there are about 1,500 people on Niue, and 22,000 Niueans living in New Zealand. And from the Cooks, there are about 15,000, 16,000 people in the Cook Islands, and about 60,000 plus living in New Zealand. So the freedom of choice they have has led to people moving, but also you get a sense of migration back the other way at particular times in their lives. One of the challenges to get our superannuation policies to understand that we need to make it possible for people to go back and contribute skills and capital at a particular point in their lives to these nations as well.
Hi, my name's Eleanor Williams. I work for the New South Wales government. I'm also a New Zealander and used to live in the East Coast Bays.
Really?
So my question is more of a strategic one. Say as little or as much as you want to. The Defence White Paper that Australia released in December had an extensive projected expenditure. There's been some comments following that Australia needs to look at building a more sustainable balance across its defence, diplomacy and development initiatives. Australia's current aid to defence ratio is pretty skewed, sort of 1-6 at the moment. I was just wondering if, looking at this balance, how do you see New Zealand's position in managing its strategic priorities, looking globally but also within the region, across that balance, defence, development, diplomacy?
Well, leaving aside the fact that that's another invitation to get myself fired, I've got a couple of thoughts for you. Firstly, I hope you're still on the roll in East Coast Bays and voting the right way, including on the flag referendum that's taking place as we speak. Prime Minister would be disappointed if I didn't mention that, it would be noted. Secondly, I'd say that my good friend, the Defence Minister, Gerry Brownlee, would love to be releasing a white paper announcing $30 billion worth of expenditure, but that's not going to happen anytime soon. So we have a more modest budget to play with. We're just looking at the white paper process again in New Zealand, and you'll see more in that space over the coming months. And obviously we focus pretty heavily on the elements that are going to provide interoperability with Australia. We acknowledge the very substantial commitment this country makes to defence of our of our region, and to its capacity to be of assistance when there are natural disasters. And so being able to operate closely with our Australian friends is a key element of what we do. But there's not much more I can say that's not going to get me fired. Just in relation to our own development expenditure, what we have discovered at a time like this in Fiji is that there's a huge call on our defence assets. And one of the things that I've been trying to do, apart from our interest in the Antarctic space, which is a big deal for us, the needs of our region when it comes to disaster recovery work sit at the very top of our list when it comes to looking at defence assets that need to be acquired over the coming period.
Thanks, Michael Saxon. Minister, it doesn't seem to be a prominent issue in recent times, but I just wonder what the current state of play is with ANZUS and visits to New Zealand of American ships.
Well, the technical answer to your question, sir, is that we are still members of ANZUS, but we're suspended members of ANZUS, and we've accepted that suspension a long time ago. And one of the things that my party did in opposition was take some steps that I think acknowledged that we would stay permanently suspended. And this was a recommendation I made to my colleagues while we were in opposition, that we should embrace the nuclear-free legislation, the legislation that makes it unlawful to have nuclear-propelled or armed warships in New Zealand ports. That's been the cause of a lot of contention with the United States for some time. But I took the view that we should, because much as we would like to be the permanent government of New Zealand, sadly we have to share those duties from time to time with the other side of politics. And having this element of our relationship with the US treated like a political yo-yo, moving around according to the vagaries of the political system, just didn't seem like any way forward. So we've accepted the policy and have worked inside it to try and create a new type of security partnership with the United States. And I'd say that we are have substantially achieved that. It's a qualitatively different relationship that we have from the one that certainly we inherited when we came into office. And we continue to work hard at it. The one remaining element is that there hasn't yet been a visit to New Zealand by a US ship. They're not prohibited under law, but the US hasn't made a decision to do so. It is public knowledge in New Zealand that the 75th anniversary of our Navy is coming up. We've invited all of our friends to be there. Some will choose to send personnel, others will send vessels. The US has said that they'll think about what they do, that's been fairly widely publicised in New Zealand. But in every other respect, the relationship is normalised, and I'm very pleased with the way we've been able to make something that was pretty challenging part of that relationship go back to something that looks normal for countries that have our history and shared values.
Minister, I might take the privilege of chair to bring you back from a large country to a very small country in our region. You've been a critic of the diminishing commitment to the rule of law in Nauru, and I can see by your face you know what I'm about to say. I think it would be difficult to say the Nauru government is improving its attitude towards democracy, freedom of speech and the rule of law. What more do you think external partners, in particularly New Zealand, and perhaps yourself, can do to encourage that respect for the rule of law in Nauru?
Yeah, There's sort of a natural division of responsibilities that occurs between New Zealand and Australia, and there are, for reasons of history or geography or whatever, we defer to Australia and in relation to Melanesia and some other parts of the Pacific, and we tend to take more of a lead role elsewhere. And so Nauru is one of those places where we acknowledge that Australia, in a development sense, has done the heavy lifting, and we've made a modest contribution in the education space and in supporting their justice system. But when a number of developments occurred, particularly the way in which a number of members of parliament were treated and some issues around the way in which the judiciary was treated, we thought this was a bit close to home. As funders of the justice system, we couldn't just say, well, we've raised our concerns and they didn't listen. I did raise our concerns pretty directly, and then I raised our concerns even more directly, but we weren't, frankly, making very much headway. And after very much reflection, we decided to suspend the justice sector support. We continue to provide the education sector support, which is a smaller part of the relationship. In doing so, I think one of the realities was, and this is why I was so slow to do it, we actually lost our leverage, and we knew that we'd be losing our leverage to some extent when we did so. I was also reluctant to, in a such an asymmetrical situation with Australia in terms of development support, to remove a small part of what was going in there as part of the total. But that's where we got to. Relationships have not really changed much. There hasn't been a further, I've made a number of attempts to see whether we can find a way forward. That hasn't been possible, and so we've just let things be parked where they are for the meantime. I'm sure there'll be a chance for us to revisit this issue, and people will be ready to talk at some point.
Thank you very much, Minister, for that considered answer. And thank you very much again for coming to speak to us today. We've learned a lot about New Zealand's foreign policy priorities for the year, and we wish you all the best in achieving your ambitions for the remainder of your term on the Security Council and for all the other policy priorities you've outlined. Please join me in thanking Murray McCulley, and look forward to seeing you next time.